Okay, we're away to the races. Go for it.
Excellent. So thank you all for attending today's session. We are very pleased and thrilled, really, to have Stephen Downs presenting with us today. As many of you probably know, Stephen is really the person who sort of coined the term Learning 2.0 and has been a real advocate for Learning 2.0 solutions now for many years. Also, dovetailing into that, as I think many of us know, really is the concept of Web 2.0 and Web 2.0 solutions and technologies. I certainly would encourage all of you on the call today post-event to Google Stephen's name via Google and follow his blog. There's a lot of things he's written about over the years in regard to this, a lot of presentations he's done over the years in regards to this, most of which, as he noted earlier, he records himself and are sort of available via his blog and in other locations. So I certainly would encourage you to follow up after the fact and learn more about what Stephen has said over the years. And he's really been a big inspiration to me in this space. In terms of today's topic, we're going to talk about Learning 2.0 and you. We talk a lot about Learning 2.0 solutions in terms of business impact or in terms of value proposition for businesses. At least that's some of the ways we've been talking about them. And really, Stephen comes at it from really a slightly different perspective, really a very learner-centric perspective on what these things can really help, how they can help an individual be more successful. So we're going to talk about what are the impacts of some of these technologies for individual learners. And then I've also asked Stephen to sort of touch on a little bit some of the things we're hearing about in this space, like, OpenID, Open Social, some of the things like social search engines like Mahalo and some of those types of things. And really just to hear his thoughts on where this stuff is going, what's coming next, and, stuff we should kind of be paying attention to. So with that, I'm going to turn the floor over to Stephen. And if you guys have questions, go ahead and put them in the chat. We had some difficulties with Stephen having trouble seeing the chat, but I'll be able to see it, and we'll jump in with your questions from the chat as you raise them. So feel free to still use that vehicle, but I'll have to be the one to ask them on your behalf as Stephen can't see the chat. So with that, Stephen, the floor is yours, and looking forward to hearing what you have to say today.
Okay, well, thanks a lot, and it's a pleasure to be able to talk with all of you today. I'm sort of pausing because I have another call coming in, but I'm not going to answer it because I am, after all, doing a presentation here, which is sort of funny, though. Just so that you can see what I look like, I'm going to bring you up here, and here I am in my office. This is my office. As you can see, they couldn't afford a ceiling. Yes. So I can sort of sometimes see the chat if I'm in this window. However, since I'll be presenting on the slides most of the time, I won't be able to see the chat. As Dave just said. So, Dave, you should feel free to interrupt me when these questions come up, and I'll be happy to allow them to direct the flow of the talk as I go along. The idea of this talk was to provide a little bit more of a personal look at e-learning 2.0, and so I began by thinking, well, what does learning 2.0 mean to me? And to put that into perspective a little bit, my work is as a researcher for the National Research Council, which is kind of an ambiguous job description, but it means that I need to write papers, it means that I need to write software sometimes, and preferably software that works. It means doing presentations. It means being on top of the trends and the new technologies. It really means learning pretty much every day. So I sat down and I thought about what it means to me and the different roles that Learning 2.0 plays in my daily life. One thing it is, I see there's a slight lag on the slides here, one thing it means to me is a place to store and to share my photos. I take hundreds of photos, thousands of photos, and with an 8-megapixel camera, each one of those photos comes in at about 3.5 megabytes. I don't have the web space or the computer space or the hard disk space to store all of those photos, but Flickr does. And it's not quite free. There is a free version, but I pay for the pro version and basically have unlimited photo storage, which I just love. It lets me do things like take 100 photos of the eclipse of the moon from last night and pick one and use that on my presentation this morning. It's a place to store my videos. And again, I just simply don't have any place to store my videos. And it's becoming more than just a place to store my videos. There are video recording services and video editing services online that allow me to actually create videos. But right now I'm doing most of that offline. But nonetheless, the photograph you see on the slide here is me at a conference talking about a diagram. There's just somebody with a video camera there, and I just put it together and tossed it up onto Google Video. And what a great way of presenting my video to a large audience. So,
I'm sorry to interrupt you, but we don't seem to be seeing your slides at the moment. It looks like you're sharing the meeting manager from the session.
Okay. What? Can you see them now?
I don't yet.
Oh, how annoying. Okay. Hang on, let's try something different then. For those of you who are here, for those of you who are here, and I've just had an emergency come in from my office. Oh boy, isn't this fun? This all worked perfectly about 2 hours ago. Let's see now.
That's sort of the law of these things. They go well in the dry runs.
Well, yeah, but the WebEx seems to be a specialist at performing differently at different times. It's just my impression here. Application. Dum-dum-dum-dum. PowerPoint. Share. All right, and I'm going to try to ignore all the distractions and focus on this now. Okay, are you able to see it now?
That looks better, yeah.
Oh, I wonder why it didn't work before. Isn't that odd? So there's my beautiful opening slide, which I guess none of you saw till now, and my picture of the moon and all of that. So now if I enlarge it like this, are you still able to see it?
Okay. And that is a beautiful picture of the moon, by the way.
Thank you. Yeah, and I didn't hear all the oohs and ahs. And,
well, let me give you one. Ooh.
I should have known something was wrong right off the bat. Okay, so there's me being a researcher. That's actually not where I am right now. That's my home office, but still the same kind of thing. And that's my e-learning 2.0 setup. And there's my Flickr account, and you can see the photo of the moon. Do you see the mouse when I move the mouse too? Or just the slide?
Yes. Yep. Yeah, it looks great.
You do?
Thank you.
Do you see the mouse when I move it?
We see a pointer. Yeah, so we see you moving around.
Perfect. Good, because I like pointing at things. Okay, so there's the video that I talked about that I tossed up on Google Video. Another thing eLearning 2.0 means is a place for me to write an essay with my colleague. We're both on this site. This is Google Docs. There's also the Zoho Writer, and there are other online writing applications. We're both working on the same document at the same time from cities that are almost 1,000 kilometers away, and just firing ideas back and forth. And of course, here's another thing that eLearning 2.0 means to me. It's a way to stay up to date, and as I say, right up to date all the time. And I want you to see this. So I'm going to pop into this. I'm going to share my web browser as well. If I can get this to work, we'll see. Share and Firefox. All right. Are you guys seeing that? I'm hoping you're seeing my RSS reader here, Google Reader on Firefox on your screen right now.
Yeah, it's coming up now, Stephen.
All right. This is my research engine, right? This is what I use every day, quite a bit of the time every day, to stay right up on top of things. Here are, for example, the Edubloggers. These are things that people wrote and you know, professionals in our field wrote today. So we have Blue Skunk Blog, Beginning Rubric 2, Word Processing, Digital Digs, and all of them. Well, okay. Why does writing make me such a jerk? Well, okay. There's the whole range of things. I subscribe to some science blogs, some design blogs, cyber culture. And what's really nice about this is this list of sources is very personal to me. And I use these sources, and with these sources of information, that's how I keep up every day with my learning. I don't go to a class on cyber culture or a class on online learning. I'm right up to date with the field every day as we go along. Now, it's also a way for me to save on phone calls, and it's sort of ironic because we're doing a teleconference here. I don't really use the telephone very much anymore, and Dave, you probably noticed that. If I have to talk to somebody in a synchronous way, typically I'll use an application like Skype. And what I like about Skype is all of my friends are listed right there, so they're very easy to contact. And I can make free audio and video phone calls anywhere around the world. My telephone won't even let me do video, but Skype will, and it doesn't cost me a dime. Learning 2.0 means knowing where I'm staying before I go there. If I go to travel somewhere, I actually look for the hotel on the map and I see what the building looks like. Now, mind you, from above, although we have the Google Street View, but it doesn't really work in Europe yet. But I see the hotel where I'm going to stay. I see where the parks are. I see where the roads are. I see where the subway stations are. Everything I need to know, I just very quickly just dash into Google Maps. I use Google Maps along with Flickr to place my photographs on a map so that every photo that I've got, I use the map to give it a precise latitude and longitude. And I also use the combination of the maps and another application called Google Pedometer to create line diagrams of the lines or the routes that I took when I cycle or when I walk somewhere. And again, it's just a way of being able to express myself more. Learning 2.0 is, for me, an easy way to draw pictures. Here's a picture that I've created on a site called Gliffy.com. And it took me, half an hour maybe, to create this diagram. You can see the diagram there. It's Personal Learning Environment is the title. Didn't take me very long to create it all. And what's nice is I create it right on this online website. This diagram is available to me whether I'm here, whether I'm at home, or whether I'm in a cyber cafe in Kuala Lumpur. It never goes away, and I can always keep working on it. I've got a whole bunch of things that I just work on. I've got various slideshows, various diagrams, articles, whatever I work on anywhere in the world thanks to these technologies. So what does this mean for the learner? Well, let's back up a little bit and think about three different views of learning resources. Here's one view of learning resources, and it's the view that we're most familiar with. The idea of a learning resource as a thing, as an object, as something static, something like a book or a course manual, or even in the online domain, we have content objects and learning objects. These things are static. So we have the idea of the learning resource as a resource that needs to be created, needs to be indexed and tagged and stored somewhere. Here's another view of a learning resource, a learning resource as an event. And this what we're taking part in right now, right? A learning resource as a class, or as a lecture, or as a seminar, or as a meeting. Now, the thing with these first two models of learning resources is they're information theoretic and they're medium-based models. And what I mean by that is that they stress the content. They stress the propositional content, the state of affairs of in the world that they purport to describe. And they stress rules. Rules both in the construction and the organization of the learning resource, but also rules in the manner in which this resource is accessed or displayed or consumed or used. Hence, we get not only things like learning object metadata, but we also get things like learning design, curriculum design, planned learning, and all of that sort of thing. But the third way of looking at learning resources and the way that eLearning 2.0 supports is the idea of learning resources as flow. This is a view of learning resources that stresses experience. It's a view of learning resources that stresses pattern recognition. The idea, the picture that I use a lot of the time when I'm trying to get this idea across is to have people think of learning resources in the way we think of water that's in our plumbing system. We just turn on the tap and we have water, or electricity in the walls. Sometimes I talk to people about thinking of learning resources the way we think of writing, and not writing as it is in books, but writing as it is in society. If you look around you now, you will see writing everywhere you need it. You want to give somebody instructions, give them a little writing. I've got a plant, it says on the side, ficus. A little piece of writing in place there, right where I need it. I have right in front of me, mesures d'urgence, renseignements sur la sécurité. I work on a French campus. Which is emergency procedures writing. So if there's a fire, what will I do? Well, I'll use some writing. And the idea here is that this writing is simply available wherever we need it. Harold Jarkey also ran a post just the other day. He said, e-learning is like a river, not like a reservoir. So what does this look like in practical terms? What does this look like from the perspective of the learner? Well, first off, and probably most importantly, learning becomes not so much a process of consuming content, but rather a process of producing content. And you see in the diagram all of the different sorts of services and things that you can use online to produce content these days. MySpace, YouTube, Blogger, GarageBand, Facebook, more and more. There are hundreds of places to create content online. And if you don't like creating content online on these third-party websites, then you can use free and open-source software such as WordPress or Drupal and create a content creation site right in your own institution. But the main point here is that learning becomes a process of creating things, and creating things not solely as an individual, but very frequently creating things in collaboration with your friends, your classmates, or with people around the world. Learning becomes a process of interacting rather than sitting in neat little rows and columns where everybody is quiet and listening to the teacher. Rather, learning now becomes the conversation going back and forth between yourself, other people in your same class, or other people around the world. I often talk, and I'm drawing from people like Thomas Kuhn and even Michael Polanyi, when I talk about learning as a process not of acquiring content, but as becoming like the sort of person you want to be, as learning as growing capacity, growing familiarity, growing a vocabulary in your own mind. The idea of learning as interaction is learning as participation with an authentic community, a community of inquiry, for example, or a community of practice, as Linger talks about. And the idea here is, as Kuhn says, to learn how to be a physicist is to learn how to solve the problems at the end of the chapter. And the way you learn how to solve the problems at the end of the chapter is you begin to think like a physicist, you become like a physicist. By participating in the community, you acquire the vocabulary, the worldview, the way of seeing the world that the physicist does. It's immersive learning. It's learning not by consumption, not by rote, but learning by doing, learning by practicing. And there are different ways of practicing immersive learning. One thing that has generated a lot of attention, people like Clark Quinn and Clark Aldrich and James Paul G, just to name a few, talk about games in learning. And here we have my favorite game on the screen. Civilization, and you'll be pleased to know that that game, which is just beginning there, about 30 hours later, I won that game. That's the thing about learning with games, is that it can become, it's immersive in the sense that it completely absorbs you. Immersive learning is not simply learning with games. Jay Cross talks a lot about workplace learning and informal learning in the workplace, where the immersive learning is learning that happens in the place where you work with the applications that you work on. There's been lots of talk about performance support systems and things like that, where the learning is located right in the application that you're trying to use. There's also learning as simulation, and those people who are familiar with the military modes of learning will know about the simulators that they use. I've personally had the experience of flying and very quickly crashing a simulated helicopter, and I think they were very happy at that point that that was a simulator. All of this together creates new roles. It creates new roles for learners, and it creates new roles for the rest of us. For the role for learner is that more and more they need to take control of their own learning. They need to create their own learning. And what I mean by this is not simply creating the learning content, but actually taking control of the learning process itself. So being able and being willing to select the object or the focus of their learning and to embed themselves or place themselves within the learning community in a context where they can learn, where they can access these resources, where they can exchange these resources back and forth together with each other. For teachers, the teacher is no longer, of course, an information delivery system. I think we've learned that there are other technologies that do that better. Teachers in the future will be doing things that humans do really well. What humans do really well is interact with other humans, and in particular in a supportive and counseling manner. So we see more and more teachers as coaches, teachers as mentors. Way back when, I once wrote a document called The Triad Model, where I talked about local or community facilitators. And part of the role of the facilitator is to coach and mentor a student, but also part of the role of the facilitator is to act as an advocate or as a broker on the part of the student, somebody who is unambiguously on the student's side when they are interacting with learning providers. And it's not on this slide, but one of the consequences of the Web 2.0 model of learning is that it becomes deinstitutionalized. And by that what I mean is that the learner in the future will no longer be receiving learning from a single provider. You saw my Google Reader there. I'm not subscribing to one or two or three sources like a researcher might have in 50 years ago. I'm subscribing to about 500 sources. A learner as well will be getting their learning from multiple sources, from multiple educational institutions, their local school, a remote school, a government agency, a health services agency. As they get older, it'll be a mixture of different colleges, different institutions, perhaps some companies who are providing learning for their products, and their employer may be providing learning for their own information system. All of this learning will be coming from a variety of different sources, and students, especially when they're young, will need somebody on their side. We'll need a broker in order to help them navigate this. For the rest of us, the idea is that part of our role changes. It used to be we just, if you were a physicist, you just went out and you did physics. If you were, an ambulance driver, you just went out and drove the ambulance. But because we want to be able to embed learners in authentic communities of practice, what that means is that as the rest of us perform our work, we need to do so in an open manner, in a manner that is very explicitly adopting a teaching role as well as a functioning role. And that's what I try to do as a researcher. I try to do my work as a researcher as much as possible in the open, because not simply does doing my work in the open help me do my work by creating and allowing me to access this community of practice, it also allows me to serve a teaching role for people who aspire to this position or similar positions. They can look at me, they can see how I do my job, they can interact with me and begin to learn ways of seeing the world, ways of treating things like evidence and data, the ways in which I evaluate learning materials, all because I do it in an open way. And in so doing, the learners learn to do the same sort of work that I do and hopefully take it a bit further. There are a lot of issues that learners need to negotiate, to navigate these days. Issues that were never issues in the past. Issues like too much information, how to filter information, what criteria they use for selection, what criteria they use to rejection. There's too many sources to scan. And of course, the question of how you obtain new sources. And then, of course, the whole idea of localizing and personalizing information, making sure that the communications that you're accessing, because it's just this constant flow, are relevant to you and relevant to what you're doing. Learning on this picture becomes, as George Siemens describes, a network phenomenon. Siemens talks about the learning approach or the learning theory called connectivism, we're learning when we learn is, again, not the collection of facts, but rather how to negotiate a network, how to work with a network to maintain connections, to be able to learn on the fly as needed. Learning becomes a web of user-generated content. And a good example of that is Wikipedia. I think Wikipedia is the classic learning 2.0 application, because of course Wikipedia is an encyclopedia that is written by its readers. It's written by learners themselves for learners, and so we have this great web of thousands of people interacting with each other and interacting with the content. And the Wikipedia articles and the discussions around the Wikipedia articles themselves become the way people learn in this new environment. Social networks, social communities. I learn a variety of things from my own social networks. Here's a picture off my own Facebook account. What does Facebook do for me? Well, in addition to connecting people, it ties me into Scrabble games, and I don't have my Scrabble game up on the screen here, but you might think, well, yeah, it's a Scrabble game, but Scrabble is a way of learning about words and a way of increasing your vocabulary, so it is, in a simple way, a learning activity. But more to the point, I use Facebook to connect with people, to exchange content back and forth with people. I've sent my photos through Facebook. I talk about code and writing software through Facebook, and of course I play Scrabble. It's learning how to navigate through a network of interactions. I talk about the learning process sometimes in terms of aggregation, remixing, repurposing, and feeding forward. By aggregating, what I mean is gathering the content from, and not just the content, but I don't like to use that word, but the resources, the connections, the activities, the media, whatever, from many different sources, gathering them together and bringing them in, remixing them, sometimes called mashing them up, is combining them in unexpected and novel ways, combining them in ways that make sense to you from your perspective. To repurpose them is to localize them, to give them your own color, your own slant, your own language, your own perspective on the world. And then, very importantly, to feed forward is to share these things with the world. Each time you do this, each time you go through this process, you're creating learning on whatever topic and in whatever subject area you happen to be working on, and each one of these steps is necessary. And where this is evolving eventually, besides a sneeze, which I'm trying to hold back on, excuse me, I failed. Sorry about that.
Bless you.
That is the first time I have sneezed during one of my presentations. I've done...
Oh, we feel honored, Stephen. Thank you.
I have never done that before. Isn't that wild? Okay, well, there you go. where all this is evolving is toward a personal learning center or a personal learning environment. And what this is, well, there's no single definition of what it is. A lot of people talk about it as a concept, and other people talk about it as an application. But the idea here is that you have a place, whether it's your browser, your computer, or just some conceptual place in your mind, from which you reach out and touch all of these different sources. If you can imagine an application, it might be an application that allows you to gather content from all of these different sources. But you don't just gather content to all of these different sources. You're also sending content. So you saw all those applications that I was working with Flickr, with Google Documents, with Gliffy. This would be the thing that connects them all, the thing that lets me take an image I've created on Gliffy and post it into a document that I'm writing on Google Docs. And right now, I just do it with a right-click copy, right-click paste, and that works perfectly well. And I have no problem so long as I'm only working with a few thousand images, a few thousand documents. But, you know, once we get into resources that are in the tens or hundreds of thousands of items, we're going to need some sort of personal information management system that allows us to access all of these things easily, to remix them, repurpose them, and to do whatever we need with them. And we need these things to feed in, not just to document sites and things like that, but into our workplace applications, into our games, into government applications, whatever. We need to be able to send our contribution, whatever it happens to be, wherever it needs to go. And so I'm talking here about not just a web of learning, but a much deeper web of living, where the learning is just one aspect of it, just one set of strands in that web. This network needs to be diverse. It needs to allow each person to access and experience multiple views, multiple perspectives. It also needs to embody multiple technologies. I was talking to somebody just yesterday who has been working on these webs of resources, and they've been recently looking at sensor networks. And I said, well, why sensor networks? And the thing is, the sources of information that we want to be able to work with are sources that come from the environment as well as from other people. So from simple things like the temperature of the oven in the other room to more complex things like the state of our stocks, for those of you who have stocks, some of us don't have stocks, to the temperature in the city that we're going to go to, or anything out there in the environment that we might be interested in, including the environment. All of these things should feed into our personal learning environment. I've envisioned, and one day I'll actually build this, I keep talking about it, a budget simulator, and this is actually a government run website that your personal environment would plug into, but what the government website does is it simulates the federal budget planning process, and each person who accesses that basically creates their own version of the federal budget. And that's fine, at one point that's just playing around with numbers, but then once you begin to connect this to, well, first of all, each other's budgets, so you can argue about them, or collaborate and create budgets, I can picture the Young Tories creating the Young Tory budget, and the Young Liberals creating the Young Liberal budget, or whatever. But also now, this thing should be plugging into resources like stock reports, Wall Street Journal articles, white papers that are created by, so that, if I'm arguing with other people about my budget, I can access these resources to support my argument. But this budget simulator should be a living system as well. It should be making projections, and those projections, like unemployment rates or tax incomes or whatever, should be based on real economic data. And this real economic data should be coming in from multiple sources across the country and around the world. What is the exact interest rate right now? What is the value of the Canadian dollar right now? All of these things should feed into this, and I should have access to all of these things right on my fingertips. And so one of the things that I would do, and I just sort of do it almost as a hobby because I'm interested in it, is just maintain my budget. I'd always be tweaking my budget. I'd go back to my budget every once in a while and tweak it a little bit and defend it from the arguments. And what's really interesting is that my budget and everybody else's budget, all taken together, can be thought of as constituting a consensus, or at least a picture of what we think the budget should look like. And so our learning about the budget can in fact feed into the process of creating a national budget. Because it would be very, very hard for a national government to pass a budget that is dramatically different from the budgets that all the people and all their budget simulators are proposing, each of them doing their own thing, but proposing as a group. The network is connected, it's interactive, it's not integrated. People talk about Web 2.0 and collaboration, and there's been some discussion about that recently. And I don't so much like the word collaboration, because it always implies that you got like six people on a boat and you're all rowing in the same direction, and of course that direction is dictated by the captain or whatever. The network isn't like that. The idea of the network is that people do their own things. They, as John Stuart Mill said, they pursue their own good in their own way. It's the picture of society that you see in Marvin Minsky's book, The Society of Mind, where the mind, the society as a whole, is created through the interaction of multiple autonomous agents, where each agent is doing their own thing. And none of the agents is thinking or creating the direction in which society as a whole moves. There is no head agent. And if you think about it, the human mind works in pretty much the same way. The human mind is a collection of neurons, intercorrected neurons, and when you look at the human mind and how the human mind functions, there's no head neuron. There's no neuron in there that's in charge. And in fact, there's not even a clump of them that's in charge. There is no autocracy of the neurons in the head. Each neuron and each clump of neurons and each part of the brain does its own thing, and intelligence and intelligent action arise as a consequence of the interactions of those things, not as a consequence of some set of those things winning a vote and swaying all the other neurons to march in line. And the network works in that way too. The intelligence is created not through collaboration, not through convincing, not through voting, but through interaction, small pieces loosely joined, each doing their own thing. The network is open. And this is important for learners as well as for people who are attempting to assist learners. The idea here is that anybody can contribute into the network, anybody can take out of the network. The idea here is that learning takes place not in a closed classroom, but in the wider, more open society. And this is an evolution that's going to take a bit of time, I think, because we're very used to the idea of, you know, everybody goes off into a room to do their learning. You know, and we used to do it that way for other things. It used to be, for example, that everybody went off into a room to do their reading, and it was called the reading room. And, you know, every good house had a reading room, and that's where you did your reading. Now you read anywhere, don't you? You read on the bus, you read on the subway. Some people read while they're driving. They shouldn't, but they do. Although, you know, even reading signs, I guess that's useful. You know, we used to have special rooms for video, too. We called them TV rooms. They replaced the reading rooms. And everybody went into the TV room because that's where the TV was. Now there's video everywhere. I've got screens surrounding me. If it wasn't for the windows, I'd have nothing but video screens to look at. It's this idea of openness. The idea of openness is the content is everywhere, the access is everywhere, and the fewer the barriers to access and sharing, the better.
Hey, Stephen, with regard to that, one of the questions that's come in via the chat is a question around sort of adoption, and in particular, you know, something like Google Docs or some of these other technologies that learners can take advantage of may conflict with corporate perceptions around open versus closed. I'm wondering if you have any thoughts on, you know, how to sort of sell this to corporate controllers who otherwise want to prevent an open exchange or close things down and have more, you know, control over that.
Yeah, it's the age-old question, and that happens not only in the corporate environment, but it also happens in the educational environment, and it's sort of ironic. I go to school sometimes, or conventions of teachers, and I said, well, all these technologies that I want to talk about, they're blocked in your school. And so it's a bit of a problem. I have many years of hard-won and bitter experience, and what that experience is that you can't convince people of things. You can make it look like you convince people of things, but you know, people make up their own minds, and the best you can do is show them. And the approach that I've always taken, right from the very beginning, is not to try to convince people, but simply to do. And in the doing, to make it obvious the advantages. And, you know, I mean, this is the other thing about people. You can't convince them, but they don't want to be left behind either. And so, you know, I'll give you a couple examples of things I've done. When I was working at Assiniboine Community College back in the 90s, and I was trying to, you know, demonstrate how effective the Internet was as a communications tool. Nobody used the Internet. They wouldn't even use their email. But everybody in the college was interested in the budget because that's where everybody got paid. You know, see what programs were going to be added to the college, and more importantly, what ones were going to be deleted. As the budget speech was being read in the legislature, I downloaded a copy of the budget and sent it to everybody in the college. And that one thing demonstrated how effective the Internet was, and email especially, as a communications tool. And there were never any questions about whether people should use email after that particular thing. Another thing, I installed and ran a web server on my desktop. I was, you know, the institution said, sorry, it's just not possible to run a web server in our environment. We just can't do it. So I ran one off of my desktop on a Windows 3.1 system. It should never have worked, but it did. And then I walked down to the computer services and, I said, open up your browser, here's the IP, type in the IP, and okay, and this is coming off my desktop, so we can. Showing is effective. Today, I say, well, these are the things that I do. People look at me and they say, how can you cover this topic? How can you cover all of these different areas or whatever? And they say, oh, you do so much. You know, they say things. And I say, well, this is what I do, and I show like the Google Reader how I keep up. I show where I put my photographs. I show how I do my videos. And people who want to, you know, other researchers at least, who want to keep up, who want to, you know, be as effective, will end up doing the same sort of things that I do. And the idea here is I don't need to convince people. If what I'm doing is more effective, then people will begin to use it. If it's not, then people won't. And it'll be me that has to look around and say, well, maybe I'm wrong. You know, nobody else is doing this. What am I missing? So when it comes back to corporations, you know, I work in the biggest corporation in the country. I work in the federal government. And my attitude is I'm open. Or in the most Canadian way, I'm as open as possible under the circumstances. What I mean by that is, you know, if there's ever a question of doubt, my default is open. If there's ever a question, my default is to disclose. If there's ever a question, my default is to publish, to write, to communicate. And people see that that helps me do my job. And they see that inside the organization as well as outside. And eventually it gets to the point where they say, well, you can't turn that off because it's working too well. That's the best answer I can give to that. It's the answer that I've always followed throughout my life.
Great. Thank you, Stephen. That was great.
Probably a bit too long, eh? Sorry about that.
But good, nonetheless.
Yeah. I mean, you should feel free to interrupt. We don't have a whole lot of time. Are there more comments or questions?
No, that was the big one. A couple of people had asked a similar sort of question on that. So I think you covered all the ground that was related to that one.
Okay. I have a presentation on my website. What was it called? It's the one I gave in North Bay. I can find it. I'm mentioning that one in particular, it's, again, Web 2.0. Everything I have is here, right? There we go. How to be a good learner. And if you have a look at this, you see the principles. These are the three principles. It's in a slide a little bit later in my slideshow as well. But interaction, usability, and relevance. These are the things that you want to highlight, especially if you're working one of these institutional contexts. And the nice thing about this presentation, I say that, you know, even knowing it's one of my presentations, is that I offer what I call guerrilla tactics. You know, things that you can do even in cases where the things that help you learn aren't necessarily present in your environment. So you can see the link for that. There's presentation/86 on my website, and that'll give you those tactics as well. See how handy this is? This is SlideShare. This is another one of these Web 2.0 sites here. I'm assuming you're able to see this web browser on your screen. And the SlideShare just allows me to share just brilliantly, simply like this. And then so, as you can see, I share all of the presentations that I do. And I also share the audio. And, I'm not going to click on the MP3 here because then we'll just get slides. But right now I'm recording the audio for this presentation, and I'll be posting the audio for this presentation and the slides for this presentation on my website. And I'll do that, you know, in the hour or 2 hours after this presentation here. And so you, all of you who were in on this presentation, who thought I talked too quickly or too much or whatever, can come and listen to the audio and view the slides. Often I take video as well, but there is no video of this one. Video is just, it's a pain to work with still. It's going to be huge, but right now it's a pain to work with.
Hey Stephen, we had another question come in for you, which may lead you to where you're going. I'm not sure, but one of the questions is, what do you think is a piece of Web 2.0 technology that's most likely to impact learning in the next 1 to 3 years? And, you know, maybe you can't single it down to one, but I think that's the question.
Yeah, it's not Second Life, although there are some interesting alternatives to Second Life, like OpenSim and Open Croquet, that have been developed. If you're interested, you should look up Dave Cormier, C-O-R-M-I-E-R, who's been messing around with OpenSim. I have to do it this way. See how this functions as my brain as well? See, it's just like it's an extension. Here we go. OpenSim and education with Alpha Software. So, yeah, if you just go to davecormier.com, you can learn about OpenSim, which is an open 3D interactive world. But I think the really big thing is going to be this personal learning environment. I think it's going to be, I mean, it's going to be nebulous. It's not going to be a technology, properly so-called, but it's going to be more and more the way people are using multimedia of all forms to express themselves. And the paradigm of that is called the lolcat. And you may have seen these lolcats, right? There's a lolcat. And all it is a picture, usually of a cat, though not necessarily, and some silly writing on it. sorry, I love these things. But the thing about lolcats is that they are the use of multimedia to create some sort of capsule comment, and you know, that neither the words nor the image represent semantically what the concept is, but you can understand what the concept is through context, through cultural associations. A lot of lolcats have some sort of cultural association or another. A lot of lolcats have references to previous lolcats, but the idea here is that the communication is transcending the communications medium. People are taking communications media and using them in forms that are totally not intended to be used. And so we're seeing this in lolcats, and then places like Facebook and MySpace and others are places where they exchange these things back and forth. And we're going to see a continuing evolution of the systems for exchanging these things back and forth. The site-based proprietary sites like Facebook and MySpace and that are, you know, an early phase of this, but they're also going to be a passing phase. And what we're going to see is an evolution of a distributed system of these things, a distributed system of identities, which will be supported by technologies like OpenID. And what OpenID will allow people to do is maintain the same identity across sites, from one site to another site to another site to another site, without logging in all the time. So they will be able to use whatever they want as a base and still interact with everyone else. I still love these lolcats. I hope you're seeing them, because they're pretty good giggles. See, this one here, I'm in your garage stealing your wheels, actually has reference to a video game and, you know, one of these massive multiplayer online games. And at one point during one of these games, one person's broadcast, you know, on the open channel to everybody else, I'm in your base killing your dudes, D-O-O-D-Z. And you know, so this reference to this video game, just it carries over and echoes and reverberates. There's a whole bunch, numerous phenomena like that on the internet, which again are just they're like these cultural semantic echoes, and they are what people who use the internet today are using as a vocabulary. It's a fascinating thing to watch, and what, you know, from the perspective of teachers, you know, what we want to do is to be able not only to tap into that vocabulary to understand it, but also learn how to and be able to use that vocabulary to express messages. You know, I mean, Here's a great example of using it to express messages. And you've probably seen this. If you haven't, you should. This is a brilliant piece of communication. And what you want to see are all the different ways that he draws from cultural and contextual cues. And of course, it's not Obama that creates this, it's just some person out there called Will I Am creates this. And you see how this is mashing up from many different sources. He's drawing in, and as Obama does, the many different cultural cues to create a message that is more than simply the sum of the text and the photos. And it's that sort of communication we are going to see more and more of. And what we need to learn as educators is how to create that sort of communication, not just as YouTube videos, that's just one medium, but in general.
Stephen, with regard to that, how do you see the interplay of some of these more creative sort of learner or user self-expression and, you know, traditional learning, like compliance and certification and things like that, that have been typically managed by a learning management system or in a hierarchical structured sort of way?
Yeah. One day there will be a separation of teaching and assessments, and when that happens, there will be an overnight crisis in the educational system because the only thing that's keeping people in classes is the credentialing. There's going to be more and more, as time goes by, pressure, and we're already seeing this in things like prior learning and assessment review movements, to credential learning that is taking place outside the traditional classroom. A lot of people are using these sorts of movements for their own ends, but there's a more genuine and more generic movement taking place. We see politically motivated instances of it in things like charter schools and in voucher systems and even in homeschooling. But there's a much wider community of people who are, as you might say, just learning. Most of the internet was built by people who just learned things on the fly, and the certification, if any, came later. And so, consequently, as we see more and more of this, and we will see more and more of this, the pressure on funders of learning, and especially governments, of course, to enable this, both through the provision of resources to make this accessible to everybody, and through the provision of processes to recognize this learning, these pressures will grow greater. And as these pressures grow greater, the pressures on funding for more traditional institutions will also grow. And people are, 10 years ago I said that people would begin to resent the funding for universities as funding basically for rich people. And I think we're beginning even today to see people question government funding for the social functions that universities provide, in an era when learning can be provided through multiple simultaneous channels. But this is going to be a gradual thing, and it's going to be, it'll hit first at the highest ends, at the professions where we already see a lot of this prior learning recognition. If you can pass the exam, you're basically in. But we're going to see this trickling, throughout the educational system, and it's motivated in part by cost, as Sir John Daniel, who's the former Chancellor of the Open University and is now with the Commonwealth of Learning, as he points out, there's 6 or 7 or whatever billion people on the planet, and half of those are of an age that they need an education, and we simply cannot build 100,000 universities. There isn't enough money in society to do that. So we have to find these alternative ways of teaching people. And this is especially the case in places like India and China and Africa and South America, but it's also increasingly the case in Canada and the United States, where we're discovering even the wealthier nations are having a more and more difficult time paying for a traditional education system. So it's going to be gradual, and you know, it's one of these, you know, frog in the water things, right? And people won't notice the pressure until it's boiling, but it's definitely happening.
Yep.
Just as an aside, to harken back to the companies and, you know, what do you do in closed company environments and things like that, similar sorts of pressures are operating with respect to the corporate environment. And again, the pressure for corporations to be more open, for example. Again, the pressures on corporations not to operate as silos, but to partner and collaborate with each other. All of these things are pressures that are happening in the background. They're pressures that are coming up as a result of the affordances created by these new technologies. And again, they're frog in the water things. You know, IBM looks like this you know, seamless vault until one day, all of a sudden, it's open and transparent. A lot of times that happens.
Yep. We're getting pretty close to time, Stephen. In fact, I think we're probably a little bit over. Do you have any sort of concluding thoughts or anything that you'd like us to walk away of, you know, sort of homework assignments of things that we can do to help educate ourselves and get moving in these directions?
Let me just very quickly point you to the key technologies, because I've shown this slide a couple of times and people are probably curious to know what the answer is. So here are the key technologies. These are the technologies to watch for. In the news, in the tech reports and that will point to where the genuine trends are. First key technology is social networking. Anything to do with social networking, and especially open social networking. Tagging, and what I mean by tagging isn't simply the specific mechanism of tagging, but rather user-generated and in-use-generated standards and taxonomies. Anything that is created through use or by users is going to be an example of this sort of phenomenon. Asynchronous JavaScript and XML, which looks like a mess, as you can see up there on the screen, but what is really very simple, is web pages that interact with web servers. All of these things that I showed you are cases of that. And more, when you see web pages that do interactive things, these will be examples of the new trends that are coming. Web servers talking with each other. REST, or representational state transfer, is a very quick and dirty way for one website to talk to another. And it's contrasted here with SOAP, Simple Object Access Protocol, which is part of the more formal and more encumbered semantic web. This is a conflict that is happening behind the scenes. The formal, structured, managed, semantic web services, ontologies, all of that, versus the user-created, fast, loose, and messy things like REST, RSS, AJAX, ATOM, and all of that. In general, the informal user-generated systems are winning. And then application program interface and mashups, you've been hearing about these all the time. Keep watching for those. A lot of the most innovative applications are going to be the results of these APIs and mashups. JavaScript object notation, watch out for this. Everybody was talking 5 years, 10 years ago about XML. This may replace XML. And then OpenID, which I mentioned earlier, is a mechanism for you to have one identity while you're on the web. It will probably be built into browsers and built into internet applications in the future. And there's going to be a much wider range of these applications that access the internet, especially when we have things like OpenID. These things like mobile web applications and dedicated web applications. There was one other thing too. Oh, what was it called? Cosmo. Watch for Cosmo. That's an open source operating system that is written entirely using C Sharp. C Sharp is the language behind the Microsoft Windows .NET framework. what Cosmo allows is for you to have very simple, lightweight computers that are Windows compliant, that are dedicated to very specific tasks. And again, it's open source and it's being written by a community, and it might end up replacing Windows. That would be very cool. That's where I want to leave you, you know, just sort of a taste of these technologies to give you a hint of the things that are coming.
That's great. Thank you, Stephen.
You're welcome.
I would ask those of you who participated today to forward any questions or thoughts you have to me, and I'll be happy to send those off to Stephen. I think a lot of times, as a presenter myself, it's valuable to hear sort of the questions and thoughts from participants. It helps sometimes those of us that present sort of go in new directions and think of new ways to approach, you know, these sort of discussions. So if you have any ideas about that or anything, send those to me. Stephen, I want to, on behalf of everyone here, thank you for your time today. I have to say I've been thinking about a lot of these issues for a while, and some of the angles that you come at this and some of the things you said today are things that I personally haven't thought of. And I consider myself reasonably adept at this stuff. So I'm sure for many people, this was a very eye-opening sort of discussion. And if nothing else, we saw some great LOL paths. So. we had actually put the phone on mute here because we were laughing so hard. So thank you for that.
No problem.
And with that, I guess we're done. So I'm going to go ahead and close out of the session. So thanks again, everyone. And again, I would really encourage you to follow Stephen's work and get up to speed, because I think it's something that really informs our industry. So thank you, Stephen, and we really appreciate your time today.
Thanks, everyone, and have yourselves a good day, and talk to you later. Bye.
Take care.